and on the phone with our Mountain Trails Report, Charlie Sturgis. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Leslie. Beautiful day out there. It actually looks like it's a little less smoky than it's been, so that's going to be kind of nice for getting out there and recreating for a change. Let's see, the big news for this weekend is the 9K trail will be officially opened. So I don't know if you've been out on parts of it, Leslie, but if you haven't, this trail certainly is kind of a little bit of a game changer, and some of the things that we'll be adding onto it next year are going to be super exciting. So we will be doing a little bit of a ribbon cutting today with some of the folks that actually put up the grant money from the state and so forth and other stakeholders. But the trail will be basically open and good to go, and just got to get out there and ride it. Other than that, I would say just keep being aware of the fact that the ruts has started, and some of the moose and deer are a little bit more excitable than normal and act a little bit erratically. And the other thing, Leslie, would be, hey, just be careful with your brakes when you're riding. It's super dusty out there still. Can't believe it hasn't rained yet, but we are super dusty, and proper braking is going to be the thing that keeps the trails safe and sound for the time being. So until we get some moisture.
Yeah,
hey, that's it, Leslie. Have a great weekend.
Hey, I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because just out on a trail, I hadn't been out in a while, but was out earlier this year on, and I was surprised by how rocky it had become, and I certainly know that I've brought home my share of dust with me. But in terms of that, some of the, you know, the trails that are considered more on the beginner side, do you go in and try to rehabilitate those now? I mean, it's so dusty. And then I think on top of that, ridden so much more than maybe had the trails have been in the past.
There is definitely a higher traffic level, and that does affect it. But the biggest thing is really probably moisture content and dust. You know, once it turns to dust and the wind can blow it away, we get a thunderstorm that washes away. So there are, you know, those are probably the big issues. But, yeah, certainly, you know, we think there's probably double the amount of trail traffic this year over last year, which the numbers are already super high anyway. And, yes, we do rehabilitate, but we kind of have to wait until a little bit more of a problem. Really, you know, like on Gamble Oaks, we did that a couple of years ago, rerouted it. And you see a few reroutes here and there, trying not to undo the trail. And some people like the technical aspect. But, yeah, we live in the mountains. It's rocky. And when we get this dry, certainly everything turns to dust, and it tends to blow away and expose the rocks.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, you're the one that's kind of mapping it and showing it as a beginner or intermediate trail when it now has become more of an expert trail.
That's a tough one. You don't want to, I don't think you really want to start changing ratings too much. I think what you really just have to live with is we see this in climbing too. Some routes wear out over time. And they get harder, but we don't really re-rate them. It's an interesting dilemma. If we thought something was a major problem, a real change, I guess we would take a real look at changing the rating, but probably would rather fix it first.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you, I mean, have your crews out there, when they're out in Round Valley, they are just like huge holes along the trails. I mean, I could stick my head and neck in there, you know. Do we know what's in those? Is it just the white hairs? Has anybody on your crew seen animals come out in and out of those?
About 99% sure they're badgers.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Because there's a lot of them.
Yeah, it seems like there's more than normal. I mean, even on the beginning of the 9K trail where there had been a hole at one point, there's like four. And I think they kind of... You know, I'm not an expert on this by any means, but I'm going to take a wing at it. I think they like the fact that once that soil's got disturbed, that they kind of come along and go, oh, someone's already done part of the work for me. So because we had on that Bonanza Loop Trail, a nice bank turn, and the badger came along and just dug a big old hole in it. And there were probably four badger holes up there as well. So Yeah, they're out there. I've never, you know, I haven't ever seen one coming and going. Yeah, they're there. So that's most likely what's digging that hole.
Okay, I was hoping you were going to say rabbits, but oh well. Okay.
Oh no, that would be an awfully big rabbit.
Well, there are some really big rabbits out there. I've seen those. Seen them dead on the road too. Yeah.
Kind of like our raccoons around here. You know, they thrive really well in Park City. So,
okay.
There are big rabbits, but no, those are not rabbit holes.
Okay. Thanks, Charlie.
All right. Bye, guys.
Charlie Sturgis with Mountain Trails Foundation. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be talking with the Open Space Management Supervisor for Basin Recreation, Jessica Kirby. She'll be joined by the Public Information Officer for the State Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, Jason Curry. They have an update on the forest restoration project taking place in Summit Park. A petition to kind of stop that work has been circulating social media. We'll be talking about why they believe the work needs to be done. Then Park City Economic Development Manager Jenny Durson in with details on a call out to artists. Imagine Park City original art for the Bonanza District. Finally, the chairman of the Wasatch Community Foundation, Tom Fowler, will be in to talk about the pillars of the organization, the projects that they're working on, and their efforts to help some 250 families during this time of COVID. Stay tuned. Well, research shows that providing high-quality education for young children yields significant long-term benefits for them and saves a lot of education dollars in the long run. KPCW has teamed up with the Early Childhood Alliance to file weekly reports about the importance of providing early educational opportunities for all children in the Wasatch Back. In this report, back in 2016, the Whitney Foundation Research Project paid for research to see how a local early childhood program is making a difference. In 2016, Holy Cross Ministries received funding from the Whitney Foundation to conduct the study of preschool graduates of their school readiness program. The Whitney Foundation supports those projects that may otherwise fall through the cracks in traditional funding sources. The school readiness program offers full-day classes Monday through Thursday and includes both academic and enrichment activities to prepare children to enter into the public school system. Emmy Gardner, the executive director of Holy Cross Ministry, says the organization tries to be an evidence-based program in terms of its interventions. So Holy Cross used the foundation money to see if the program they had established for young, low-income Spanish-speaking preschoolers was making a difference.
One of our mantras at Holy Cross is, you know, let's find a need and meet it. And we wanted to make sure if we really had found a need or if we were just kind of doing something that we thought made sense but maybe wasn't having that impact. So when this opportunity came with Whitney Foundation to do this longitudinal study, we really looked at it as an opportunity to say, let's take qualitative and quantitative data. We did interviews, right? And then we looked at test scores to really say, did what we create make a meaningful difference in the lives of these little ones, and did it really help give them that great, you know, start and launch into their academic careers? And
Gardner says they saw impressive outcomes in both kindergarten and third grade test scores, and those who were part of their program were on par with their English speaking counterparts years later. One of the biggest takeaways from the study, she says, was the need to work with the parents as much as with the children to help them understand the role they play in their children's achievements.
Those children who did better academically tended to have parents who really were more engaged and invested with their students in their academic function. And what I mean by that is, you know, asking, do you have homework? What are you doing? Reading with them, working with them, and really helping the children see that sort of power of knowledge and learning, right? Versus parents who may have said, oh my gosh, I know you've had a really busy day. It's okay. You can like sit down and watch TV.
Holy Cross conducted the study in partnership with the University of Utah's Department of Family and Consumer Studies. Professor Cheryl Wright says they incorporated both quantitative and qualitative data on children in Park City and the impact of Holy Cross's programs on their current academic success. Wright helped create the research team and analyze the data. A critical aspect of the work, she says, was the access that Holy Cross had with families who would prefer to stay under the radar.
One of the things that I think is so important about this study is it's really hard to recruit and do this kind of work with vulnerable families. And there was also, you know, obstacles with the political climate that was going on where, you know, we were asking people to, information with us. But Holy Cross Ministries has developed an incredible amount of trust in this community. They were able to implement this study, whereas a lot of other researchers have trouble reaching these families.
123 interviews were conducted with parents who represented 133 children. The study looked at students in this program as well as other preschools, including the Park City School District's preschool, as well as children who were not in preschool. Wright says the data shows that based on test scores, this culturally sensitive program even had better outcomes than the program being offered by the school district. The majority of students who attended Holy Cross Ministry School Readiness Program, she says, scored higher on literacy measures than those in other preschools and significantly higher than those children who were not in preschool.
It was my understanding that most of the teachers were bilingual and, you know, talked to the children in Spanish, and that they really understood these families, developed trust with these families. So I think they had the advantage over the school district's program because their program was designed for these families.
Wright added that the data did show that the bilingual teachers could have done a better job giving their native Spanish speaker students more exposure to the English language. You can read more about the research findings on our website, kpcw.org. Well, the Snyderville Basin Recreation District is underway with its forest health and fuels reduction project in Summit Park. But while they're trying to do the right thing, they're also up against a lot of criticism, even a petition protesting the work that's being done. In the studio, I have Jessica Kirby. She's Basin Rec's Open Space Management Supervisor. On the phone with me, I have State Forestry, Fire, and State Lands Public Information Officer Jason Curry. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Good. Hey, Jessica, so some 350 people have signed this Save Summit Park's High Desert Forest Protection Plan, alleging that the work that the district is doing is very aggressive and even questioning some of the tactics you're using. Would you like to respond to their criticism?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. We've heard a lot from the community about some misconceptions that are being put out in this petition. The petition is inaccurately stating the size of tree that we are taking out in this treatment, and it's rallying folks around what is called old growth trees, and the district's guidelines are being strictly adhered to in this project. We are not cutting old growth trees out of Summit Park. There is a situation in our shaded fuel break area that we are adhering to the guidelines where some large trees have been taken out. But the petition also shows a photograph of a tree that was damaged during our windstorm last week. And unfortunately, that tree and another one next to it, the crown tops had broken, and we had to take those out for public safety. And I think that's really what started the petition. And it's a very emotional topic, and that is expressed very deeply in that petition.
Yeah, one of the points of their petition is that the Basin Rec crews have walked right past trees laying on the ground and go ahead and cut down healthy old growth trees with, you know, 30 inch diameters, and they want to know why that's being done. Is that the example you're using here?
Yeah, correct. 30 inch diameter. There's a little misunderstanding about diameter and circumference. Diameter of the tree that we are targeting is 10 inches, not 30 inches. So that's almost a three-time fold of difference in that. And the particular tree that they're speaking of was actually not in the active project area. It is on the other side of Summit Park. We will be doing some treatment in that area, but at this point we are not. But regardless, the diameter of the tree is where that misconception is coming from. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe take a step back and tell us why Basin Rec kind of started with this project in the first place.
Sure. I mean, this started in 2015 and has been something that we've been studying with the conservation easement holder of Summit Park, which is the Utah Forestry and State Lands Department. We've been working hand in hand with their state forester, with the local fire authorities, with the county. We've gone to county council in 2019, projecting this project. It's been something we've been talking about for a long time. The Forest Health Stewardship Plan that is on the property gave us some guidelines to take a look at the forest health and the fire risk for that community. It's a property that sits among three populated subdivisions, so it's a little different than some of our other open space where we have a responsibility to be good neighbors and good partners and treat the property in a way that can help public safety and forest health.
And the neighborhood you're talking about, of course, Summit Park, Timberline, and Pinebrook.
Correct, yeah.
Jason, can you talk to us a little bit about the role that your department has in this project?
Yeah, sure. So we have the conservation easement there, first of all, that requires us to maintain the land from a conservation standpoint, and that's important. But our area forester has put in a lot of time and effort and, frankly, a lot of science and background knowledge about how to maintain and improve forest health while also accomplishing the objective of creating a safer space there for the nearby homes. So our division is kind of twofold, with the conservation easement and with our forestry expert there in the area.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about how this would make a difference, though. I mean, we've seen what's happened to the California forest fires. I mean, are we in a similar situation here in this area?
Well, we could be. In a lot of those areas, what we've seen is ultimately there's no action, there's no management, and so there's overgrowth. Think of it as kind of like a garden. If you don't thin your garden, there's going to be problems. There's going to be too much of material, and in a forest environment, not only is that going to mean lower forest health and the species like Douglas fir and everything else that wildlife depends on can't thrive, but there's also a huge wildfire danger. So what we've done in this project is to mimic some of nature's actions that make a healthier forest. For example, some of the thinning that's been talked about, the installation of the shaded fuel break. These things mimic activities like fire and wildlife foraging to break up the continuity and to break up the density of this vegetation so that it's ultimately healthier, and it favors larger, healthier trees overall.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about just the erosion issues. I mean, when you start, because some of this is on pretty steep hillsides, when you start cutting down trees, do we now risk landslides, mudslides?
It's always something that we were concerned about, but most of this has been done with hand crews. And so that allows us to be very selective and cut trees with that exact thing in mind. We have to leave enough material there so that the soil is held in place. So really that's very low probability.
Okay. When does the project finish up here? Does it continue over, this fall, next spring?
Yes. So the initial plan was to have a 4 to 5 year phased plan. Not knowing the specifics or how fast the crews could get through a property of this size, and as this is our first time doing a large-scale property like this. They've got about 3 days of work left in the initial treatment, which was 131 acres is what they're doing right now. Because we have a little bit of additional funding and because we have time before the snow sets in, we might shift the crews over to phase two and get them to work until the snow falls. So there's a possibility we might go another couple weeks on the project, and we're discussing that right now as far as, but as far as the initial plan, it would be done on Monday, Tuesday-ish of next week.
Okay, so we're talking about another 70 acres in phase two?
Phase two is could be up to 80 acres, but we'd likely pare that down just slightly, yeah.
Yeah. Have you done this in any of your other open space areas?
Absolutely. We've done smaller renditions of these shaded fuel breaks. One was in Toll Canyon. We started in 2016. We continued that break in 2017 and 18, creating a needed connection that put a break in between Pine Brook and Summit Park. But the Utah Forestry and Fire State Lands has been doing work in this area since 2000. They've done work 2000, 2003, 2006 in different areas in Summit Park and Pine Brook. And so really what we're trying to do is maintain those shaded fuel break corridors and to maintain those breaks so that when the fire comes through, there is something to slow it down.
Yeah. So besides the benefit of, taking down the fire, potential fire risk, Jason, I mean, what are some of the other benefits then in terms of doing something like this?
Well, it ultimately will benefit wildlife to a great degree. What this will do is promote some of the forage shrubs and other things. It will also help native species versus noxious weeds and other things. So wildlife habitat will be improved. And then just overall, again, forest health. These forested montane woodlands, they thrive on disturbance. And things like fire and wildlife foraging have been absent. And as we try to mimic those actions, those natural actions through our efforts in the project, we hope to see a healthier forest.
Okay. And then there's also the petition notes that Basin Rec's crews have built bonfire-sized piles in using the cutting scraps that they plan to burn. Is there a plan for a controlled burn in this area?
Yeah, that's another one of those misconceptions. The bonfire-sized piles, they are sticking to the prescription that was given to us from the forestry. These are standard-sized burn piles that are typically used in forest practice. We are not doing a prescribed burn in Summit Park. These piles will be burned in the fall once snow is on the ground. It will be under really contained conditions, and we pay close attention to air quality while we do these burns. We've successfully burned 250 piles in Toll Canyon already. We will be doing upwards of 250 piles this fall into winter. So it's something that we have qualified contractors to work with us. There's retired smoke jumpers and burn bosses that are doing this work for us that we've hired. And like I said, we've successfully done these piles before.
Okay. Anything else either of you would like to mention?
You know, I just like to throw in that we, as a district, appreciate the public's concerns and feedback on projects like this. And what we learned through this project is, you know, continual education and community outreach is something that the district is focusing on, and we'll continue that to do that. And we encourage the public to, you know, keep having communications with us and encouraging that education.
And Jason, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, we always view it as a positive sign when the public is watching what we're doing and paying attention. We just encourage everybody to go to Basin Recreation's project page and read about this and see really what how much science, how much thought, and how much experience goes into this and ultimately the success that we hope to achieve.
Okay. Jason Curry, Jessica Kirby, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:32. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, Park City has put out a request for proposal to artists. The city's looking to commission original artwork that will be printed on the construction fencing around the future site of the Arts and Culture District. In the studio with details, I have Park City Economic Development Manager Jenny Dearson. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the RFP is live?
The RFP is live. It's been live for about a week and a half, and we're super excited to announce this opportunity to the community. We are just looking for original artwork. It can be from artists. It could also be from school kids, or if you're looking for something to do this weekend and you want to come up with a design and submit it to the city, then we'll look at all those designs in a couple of weeks, and we're hoping to select four images and have those printed onto the fencing.
Okay. So when is the deadline to submit?
The deadline to submit is on Monday, October 5th at noon. And at that point in time, we'll compile all the submissions, and the Public Art Board will review them as part of a public meeting and then make recommendations to the City Council for final selection.
Okay, so you say you're going to award four images, four different people, or it could be the same artist, or?
You know, an artist can apply multiple times, and so it could potentially be the same artist, but it will be four different submissions or four different artworks. So when you're submitting, you don't need to come up with four images. It's just we're looking for one image. And I think another good thing is when we did the utility boxes, this is a very similar process to that. For instance, we had a whole classroom come together and submit a piece of artwork from, you know, Jeremy Rant or one of the schools. And so the same thing, you can get together with your friends or if you have a club at school or something and you want to participate. It's just a really fun opportunity to get the community involved.
Okay. How much fencing is going to be needed for this project?
Well, the fencing is going to be large. So the fence itself will be 6 feet tall, but it's 2,200 linear feet. And so we've also had some artists asking, do they need to plan a design that's going to wrap around the entire fence? And they don't need to worry about that. Once we acquire the images, we'll actually scan them, and it'll go to a different company, again, much like the utility boxes. Well, they'll either be printing or affixing those images in multiple ways to the fencing.
Okay. They just need to do the artwork. You'll take care of everything else.
That's right.
Yeah. Is fencing screening the fencing now required by city code or something?
It is not, but this one in particular, it's an arts and culture district, and we didn't want to miss the first opportunity. And just, again, thought it would be a really fun thing to do in the fall to get our community involved and excited about that project.
All right, and how much will people receive?
The stipend for the artist that's selected is $600 per image. So the total project is $2,400. You know, again, it's really fun, you know, when we see artwork from kids or community members and then also artists that are here local in the community and even some abroad, all competing for the same thing. And I think the theme's really important. Imagine Park City, and arts and culture is one of our pillars, and I think it's vital to our community, but to really see how people think about the community's values and all these ideas and what they come up with. And I think that's what's special about art is we all have a different idea and a way to show that visually. And we have already received a couple of submissions, and just even seeing those, I mean, it's incredible what people are coming up with, and we're excited about the project.
Interesting. Imagine Park City. I mean, that's pretty broad theme.
It is a broad theme, but you know, again, when you read in that call for artists, it does tie to the community values, which historic character, sense of community, natural setting, small town, and those are broad as well. But I think to each of us, we know how unique Park City is, and we all have that imagination of what we want it to be in the future as well.
All right. And then once selected, this basically the art becomes city property. You could use it any way you wanted?
That is true. And so, the utility boxes that we did about 2 years ago now, all of those images are framed in City Hall, and those become part of our public art collection, and those will be fun to see around the community as well.
All right. Can you give us an update on the parcel? I mean, demolition starting sometime soon?
I don't have a ton of information. Demolition is set to start this fall, I believe in November, as far as I know. And so we're just got to start rocking and rolling on that project. And it will take some time. And I think that's important for the community to know. And another reason we want this project, and we want it to be more than just green construction fencing. It's going to take a while to complete the project.
All right. Any idea when the master plan for the district will be presented to Planning Commission?
I am also not sure, but I'm assuming it's going to be coming up pretty quick here in the fall as well.
Okay. Hey, anything else you want to update us on? Halloween's canceled. We should know that.
Halloween is canceled, and I would encourage the community as we continue to move towards the fall and winter, continue to do the things we've all been doing, washing the hands and keeping those masks on when you are out and around and doing things. I know it's tough, and I know how much fun Halloween is, but start to go ahead and plan that holiday and how you're going to do that safely. And you know, hopefully things shall pass in time and we'll be back to all those things. I do think we miss some of the community events, whether it was Miner's Day or 4th of July or Halloween. Those events really do mark who we are. And I know that we're celebrating those things safely, and we'll hopefully be back with those in future years.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, but thank you so much for having me.
It's Jenny Dearson from Park City Municipal. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:37. Well, State Route 224, also known as Marsac Avenue in the Upper Reaches, is seeing more traffic due to new growth and more people wanting to visit Scenic Guardsman's Pass. But as KPCW's Jessica Lowell reports, the seasonal road is dangerous, and someone want to know why it's still being used when a much safer alternative exists.
Marsac Avenue is the road that leads up to the Empire Pass development, Brayden Estates, and Gardman Pass, which connects Park City, Midway, and Big Cottonwood Canyon. Marsac is steep, narrow, and doesn't have guardrails. In a 30-day span, there were two commercial vehicle accidents. During the most recent one, a truck fell over the hillside and closed the road in both directions for 4 hours. Courtney Samuel is with Utah's Department of Transportation. He says, despite the accidents, right now there are no plans to improve the popular state road.
At this time, we currently do not have any active projects for Empire Pass. I know anytime there is a crash, we always take a look into it and see if there's anything that can be done from an engineering perspective to improve safety.
He says part of the reason is because there haven't been enough serious accidents on the road in the past decade to justify the expense of road improvements.
We have about 11 years of crash data there, and so fortunately there hasn't been a ton of serious crashes in that area. There's been 119 crashes total, and out of the 119, there's only been three suspected serious crash injuries there.
And Samuel says it would also be difficult to get enough room on the road to implement safety measures.
There's twists, there's turns, and there's not a lot of shoulder. There's sections where there isn't a place to put a guardrail. You would have to go in and widen the road and expand it to be able to put a guardrail there. And so we haven't had any projects at this time that are going to do that.
But there's an alternative route that also leads to Guardsman Pass. Twisted Branch Road runs parallel to Marsac Ave, but the road isn't publicly owned. Joe Butterfield, a longtime resident in Park City, spoke at Wednesday's City Planning Commission meeting. He says Twisted Branch Road offers a safer alternative to Marsac.
It's there. It goes to the exact same place. It is safe. It is year-round. It's built to accommodate the traffic that is going up there. But what it isn't public. It's not being used by the public because the developer doesn't want the traffic. Plain and simple.
Butterfield says the city has encouraged traffic on the road by continuing to approve development in the area, as well as purchasing and improving Bonanza Flat, which has made it an even more popular area to drive. Traffic on the road, he says, has nearly doubled. But Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson told KPCW that recent accidents and traffic aren't the norm.
I think you saw kind of a large anomaly when Parley's Summit was closed because of the Parley's fire on I-80.
Butterfield disagrees and says the problem isn't that there are too many people on the road. It's that no one will address the safety issues.
This issue on the Empire Pass Road has been one that's been ignored for far too long. The road above the Montage is a public safety issue. It is not an access issue. It is not a backdoor issue. It is solely a public safety issue. Sadly, our council and our mayor have neglected it and kicked it down the road and labeled it as a access issue.
And he says if local officials don't address the issue soon, it could lead to much more severe accidents.
But it is only a matter of time before someone's father, someone's mother, brother, sister, son, or daughter dies on that road. And I hope that this commission, the mayor, and council stop allowing developers to push their base, equalize the public safety for all of us, stop any new development until Twisted Branch is public.
Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson said the city doesn't have plans to abandon 224 and open Twisted Branch Road to the public.
I think the city is regrouping a little bit on what we want to do here and whether or not we need to take some action.
The Park City Planning Commission is expected to discuss the Twisted Branch subdivision, which proposes even more development in the area, at its next meeting, October 14th. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Park City is 5 months into a 10-year vision for the future of the community called Park City Vision 2020. KPCW's Sean Higgins reports despite COVID-19 throwing a monkey wrench in 2020, the city will still be driving ahead with their long-term plans.
The timing could not have been much worse. 3 months into 2020 and the world turning upside down amid the COVID-19 pandemic is not an ideal time to be launching Park City's new 10-year vision for the community. The Park City City Council discussed the possibility of reprioritizing the vision at their meeting on Tuesday after putting the project on hold in March. The council ultimately decided to go ahead with the plans while still keeping an eye on COVID-19. The Park City Vision 2020 process actually began in June of 2019 and is an effort by the city to provide an open, inclusive, and transparent future for Park City. Approximately 1,700 residents and community stakeholders participated in the 8-month visioning process, which included 2 large online community surveys, engagement sessions, focus groups, and 2 future summits where these important issues were discussed. Park City's last visioning process took place in 2009, and Vision 2020 looks ahead to 2030 to identify what needs to happen in order to meet the aspirations and demands the city faces now and will face over the next decade. The visioning process identified 5 key areas that need attention over the next 10 years: transportation innovation, affordability and equity, sustainable tourism, environmental leadership, and arts, culture, and local economy. Naturally, with a global pandemic greatly affecting daily life in Park City, priorities are bound to change some, but Park City Councilmember Max Doyle urged his colleagues to be proactive when looking at the current situation.
We've talked a couple of times about not continuing to be reactionary, but to be proactive in our behavior. And I think that for the most part, we'll land pretty close to where we did in February with that in mind. But if we were reactionary, which seems to be the case these days, I personally, the thing that is highlighted and maybe elevated is the affordability and equity.
Doyle said, given the economic strain put on many local families during the pandemic, issues like the cost of living in the community have been magnified. Councilmember Becca Gerber agreed.
I do feel like the word resiliency is going to be an important word to maybe incorporate into some of our discussions, because how we bounce back from COVID and how we move forward with our goals, I think it's going to take a lot of resiliency. And it's kind of something that you couldn't even begin to expect when we first started our visioning project. But COVID has definitely changed the discussion, and I think it's going to change the discussion of the way we move forward a lot for a few years.
Gerber said housing is another aspect of Park City's future that cannot be ignored. With the pandemic actually driving up the cost of homes and a record number of home sales recorded so far this year, options are becoming more and more scarce for families in the market for a home but can't afford to pay $1 million or more to live in Park City. Councilmember Steve Joyce told KPCW the city is right to address the current needs of the community, but believes rebooting the Vision 2020 initiative is the next step in tackling the big issues on the horizon.
We're always doing things, but what we were looking for is the next big steps to take. And quite frankly, the last 6 months, we haven't been focused on what are the next big steps that we should take. So I think this was step one of getting back to that and getting the community back engaged and getting our staff and our council back engaged to start thinking that way.
Joyce said, although there is no set plan in place yet to implement all of the Vision 2020 plans, the city will be working to bring them to life as the year progresses. More information on Park City Vision 2020 can be found through a link on our website, KPCW.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
The Wasatch Community Foundation's mission is to advance the well-being of Wasatch County residents by uniting community resources and programs through a number of pillars. On the phone to tell us more, I have the chairman of the Wasatch Community Foundation, Tom Fowler. Good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning.
So just start us off with a bit of background. When did the foundation form?
So the formation of the foundation started in the early 2003, by a number of gentlemen here in the Valley who looked at the expansion of how fast we were growing and determined we needed to have hopefully one 501c3 that could support the whole community. So what he did is he formed the foundation, and it has what we call pillars. There's 5 pillars to the organization. There's a health pillar, an education pillar, a recreation pillar, an arts pillar, and a human services pillar. Each one of those pillars has its own chair and its own committee. They develop programs for the Valley. We meet as a board to determine which one of those programs we wanted to establish for the year, and then we move forward from there. And it's worked fairly well over the last 15 or 20 years.
Yeah. So did the foundation start with an endowment?
No, it did not. To be honest, the way they started it was the gentleman who is Jim Ritchie, who's a phenomenal person in our valley. He started it out. He asked five other individuals to join him. Each one of those had to put an X amount of dollars beyond the committee, and that's how it started. They went out and fundraised it within the valley. The goal was, instead of having four or five different 501c3s going out and asking the same businesses and the same individuals for a donation, if we could have a broad enough foundation that supported the valley, that the individuals could give one time a year, and then that money would go to the different programs that were being established.
So do you essentially just spend down then the fund every year based on what you raise?
We have a basis, certainly nowhere near what Park City would have, but we have a fund that stays, and every year we do raise. Now, the goal that we started for 2020, but now with COVID, and we'll get into that in a minute, certainly things have kind of changed the way we're focused with the foundation. The goal is to create an endowment over the next 2 or 3 years.
Okay. So you do have a fund that you're able to draw interest from, or no?
Yes.
As you mentioned, the foundation focuses on these five pillars. Are the distributions split about evenly between them?
As far as the monies that we're applying?
Yes.
No. So going back to some of the big programs that we've established and helped, one was our Wasatch Rec Center, a beautiful recreation center that we have. Obviously, during that time, most of the money being raised was going to support that. We have the Intermountain Dialysis Center, which I'm sure Park City is aware of. Those were monies that significantly was brought in that donated for that. The work that we did to bring the UVU campus here to the Valley was another one. So over time, there would be some significant programs that we focus on over time.
All right. In addition, does the Heber Valley have an education foundation, a separate one?
Yes, it did. So last year, which is when we started to reestablish or change the way we're looking at the foundation, education, which I'll call the scholarship program, which I think is probably big in Park City as well. The scholarship program was part of the Wasatch Community Foundation, the education pillar. Last year, mid-year, the decision was made, just as you're structured in Park City, to separate education and have their own pillar. So they did do that. We do work with them on programs, but in general, they're different types of programs. Like I said, one of the big programs that we're going to be working on this year is to work with UVU and bring a hospitality program to UVU. We would hope it's at least a national, could be a global type program. You certainly can use it considering what Park City and Heber has as far as hospitality. And we're working with that group to establish that program at UVU. So that's something the education group, as far as the education foundation, wouldn't be looking at.
All right. And as you mentioned, I mean, certainly some challenge given the COVID pandemic. I mean, how has the foundation been able to help the Heber Valley community?
Yeah, so, we were doing very well, probably like many come January, and things were going along very smoothly. And then this pandemic hit, and we came in as a board and says, okay, what do we do? So what we established was we partnered with, obviously, CCPC, which I'm sure you know very well. They also have a presence here in our valley. And the other, we partnered with St. Mary's Church, which I'm sure you're very familiar with in Park City. St. Lawrence Catholic Church is a mission of St. Mary's. So the administration work is done by St. Mary's. So we became a fundraiser. We became a group that gave the names of the families that we knew needed help. When you look at our community, many of our people work in Park City in the hospitality area, as you know. And many of them were having very difficult times. So we raised about $140,000. We worked with those two groups. We gave them the names. They were able to vet those families and we supported their rent, their insurance payments, their utility payments. The payments did not go directly to the family, but went to those other landlords or utility companies or insurance companies. And so we've probably helped 250 families in our valley get through this pandemic. The good news is it's slowing down. We've talked to CCPC. They're seeing the same thing. So hopefully we're moving out of it, but we're still heavily engaged.
Sure. So how did your organization qualify those people most in need?
Well, again, CCPC did the venting. And so what they would do is they have a significant database of those families today because they're helping them at the food pantries and other places. They would call them. They would ask them where the issues were economically for them. They'd ask for the information that they could call the landlords, the utility companies, whoever they were. And then they would call those companies and negotiate, say, we're going to help pay down some of this debt. The other thing they did, which was a phenomenal approach, was they asked them to relieve some of those burdens from those families as well. It was limited to a $500 payment. Many of these families got 2 to 3 payments over the 4 or 5 months.
Okay. Any other projects that you have going at this point?
Yeah, so a couple of things I'd like to mention. One is a couple of the programs that we do is a backpack program, which I'm sure Park City has as well for some of their children. We have a backpack program that supports those families on the weekends. So every weekend, these children get a bag of groceries that they could take home for the weekend. We also have what we call the Christmas backpack program, which obviously these same children could be off of school for 10 days, 12 days. So during the break, before that break occurs, these children are given a slew of groceries that helpfully weigh them over this time. So that's being done. The other thing I like to mention is we have what we call a Thanksgiving dinner that's promoted by the Wasatch Community Foundation. We put it on. And we call it a celebration for the valley. And we invite anyone from the family to come. We're trying to ensure that families that may not have the financial means to have a good Thanksgiving dinner can have one. Cowboy poetry, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know about cowboy poetry, the Western Music Festival. And so what we're able to do is bring some of those bands in, so there's music. We have a coat drive, glove and coat drive that we do, giving out that to those families. We have the hospital come in and do simple tests. So it's a big means to get our community together, and it's a cross-section of all of our individuals living in our community. We're going to have to cancel that this year because of COVID. We work with the Wasatch Health Department and Intermountain Hospital, and they've recommended that we not do that this year. So for your audience and those that are listening from Wasatch, and we'll get more word out, we're going to have to cancel that this year. This would have been our 6th year, so it's been a phenomenal success. We feed 500-600 people during that celebration. Our goal this year will be, again, to work with CCPC, the Heber Valley portion of that, and provide Thanksgiving dinners to these families.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Tom?
No, I think that's it. I'm glad to get the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
For those who maybe want to contribute to your efforts, is they do that on your website or?
Yeah, I was just going to say, people who want to learn more about the Wasatch Community Foundation, be engaged with us. We'd love that, to have people engage with us. Take a look at some of the programs that we have. They can go to www.rwcf.org. That's www.rwcf.org.
Okay. Hey, Tom Fowlers, chairman of the Wasatch Community Foundation. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This is KPCW Park City. Have a good weekend.